Thanks a lot for the organizers for giving me an opportunity to speak at this conference. So the topic is toward random tensor networks and holographic codes in CFT, and it's based on these two papers. The first one is with Tom Hartman. So since people have mostly discussed about tensor networks, let me keep the introduction very short. So tensor networks provide a succinct and computationally useful graphical description of many-body quantum states. They are particularly interesting from the point of view of holography because they define error-correcting codes which serve as toy models of holography in a setup where the bulk geometry is discretized. Some of the famous holographic tensor network models which have helped shed light on some puzzling features of holography like bulk reconstruction, the RT formula, etc., are the MeRA, the Happy Code, and the random tensor network model. And these models display a striking interplay between quantum information theory and quantum gravity and have played an important role in the recent developments made in understanding the black hole information paradox. However, the black hole interior is relatively less understood from the point of view of bulk reconstruction. But having said that, there is a very promising direction advocated in these papers about reconstructing the black hole interior using the framework of non-isometric codes. So here is a cartoon sketch of the spatial slice of a black hole, which looks like a bag of gold or a one-sided python, interpreted as a holographic code. So there are regions, there are spatial regions which act isometrically, that is the outside of the black hole and the region from the trivial surface to the bulge. And then there's the region from the bulge to the horizon, which acts, which seems to act non-isometrically. Let me say, this is just a cartoon picture. I'm going to talk about the actual model. And as an example of this bag of gold geometry, you can consider an evaporating black hole at late times, which has a lot of EFT degrees of freedom. And since the dimension of the EFT Hilbert space is very large as compared to e to the s black hole, implies the holographic code is necessarily non-isometric. Now comes to the important question, like how are non-isometric codes realized in quantum gravity? So we address this question in our work, primarily by working in an ADS3 CFT2 context. So we constructed tensor network models for black holes directly using the OPE data of the dual CFT. And we showed that in the regime where the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis applies, the CFT tensor networks describe random tensor network models. And quite interestingly, the same ETH regime also reproduces wormhole amplitudes from CFT, which we showed in this paper. And our models describe holographic codes that transition from being isometric outside the black hole to being non-isometric inside. So I feel this is an important step toward constructing a model of the black hole interior using CFTs. Okay, so in this talk, I shall provide a prescription for turning pure states in 2D CFT into random tensor networks, and I will describe how describe the three-dimensional bulk geometries that are discretized by these networks. And then I shall add probe matter to the black hole background and show that the portion of the holographic code described by the probe OPE undergoes an isometric transition across the horizon. And then I'll show that our tensor networks also exhibit a toy version of the island rule formula. And then finally, I'll describe Euclidean wormholes by coarse graining the tensor networks. So let me start by talking about how to construct tensor networks from 2D CFT. So consider a CFT state which is created by the action of Virasoro primary operators on the vacuum. So here there are a bunch of operators which are being which are acting on the vacuum, and these I's are, you can think of them as some kind of a flavor labels. Now expand the OPE in some channel, and that is which is what I've done in the second line. And the sum involves an infinite sum over intermediate primaries. And these C's are the OP coefficients. And they capture the contribution from Virasoro primaries. And then the quantity B that you see here is what is known as an OPE block. An OPE block packages together the contributions of Virasoro descendants. And it is completely fixed by conformal symmetry. And the norm of the state is a 2m point CFT correlator, which is expanded in conformal blocks, as I've shown in the next step. Now, when the norm of the state is dominated by a saddle point at large central charge, we truncate the sum to a microcanonical window around the saddle point weights. There are two nice things that happen. So one, the infinite sum over primaries gets truncated to a finite sum. and two, the OP block just factors out. So the reason is that the OP block only depends on the conformal weights of the primaries, and it doesn't actually depend on the primaries themselves. So it can be pulled out of the sum. And what I mean by B star is the OP block evaluated at the saddle point weights. Now HK as you see in the sum, this HK, it's an auxiliary space of Virasoro primaries around the saddle point weights. And the dimension of this auxiliary space is set by the Cardy formula, which is given by S naught evaluated at the conformal weights. Okay, so basically what I've done is I've turned a semi-classical CFT state into a one-dimensional tensor network with the architecture of a matrix product state. And this is a very simple tensor network which is constructed from two building blocks. So the first building block is the OPE tensor, which is a three-index tensor. And the second building block is the OPE block, which is a two-index tensor. So the OPE tensor legs label finite-dimensional primary finite-dimensional space of Virasoro primaries, and the OP block maps this auxiliary space of Virasoro primaries into the physical CFT Hilbert space. So basically, in words, what is happening is the OP tensor contractions define an auxiliary primary state, which is dressed by Virasoro descendants, which correspond to boundary gravitons in the bulk. Now, let me tell you how to turn this into a random tensor network. So 2D CFTs obey a version of the Eigenstadt thermalization hypothesis, which incorporates Virasoro symmetry. It's sometimes called the Virasoro ETH. It basically says that the OP coefficients, you can treat them as Gaussian random variables with vanishing mean and variance set by this smooth function C0 of conformal weights. You see that there are dots after that, and those dots come from locality constraints which require that there are non-Gaussianities. I'll have something to say about this at the end. And you can actually reproduce this function C0 from the bulk by computing the partition function of a Euclidean wormhole geometry. So basically, that's what we showed in this paper. And as you can see in this figure, if you compute the gravitational partition function on this particular two-boundary wormhole with the topology of a thrice-punctured sphere times an interval, you can reproduce this smooth function, C0. Okay, so basically what we have done is we have taken the tensor network representation of CFT states and then used Virasoro ETH and combined it with Virasoro ETH to get a random tensor network model constructed using 2D CFTs. And this this approach is quite general. So you could also do it in higher dimensions where you use the usual ETH to turn CFT states into tensor networks. Okay, so that was the CFT part of the discussion. Now coming to the gravity side. So I'll talk about how these tensor networks relate to the bulk geometries. So consider, as an example, consider probably the simplest pure state black hole in 3D gravity, which is a black hole formed by the back reaction of two heavy point particles, and it is dual to the CFT state, as shown here. And the norm of this CFT state can be computed holographically using the gravitational partition function on the hyperbolic ball geometry with the world lengths of two heavy particles. And this geometry is time symmetric. And if you look at the geometry of this spatial slice, it looks like a twice punctured hyperbolic disk with a minimal surface. That minimal surface is the apparent horizon on the time symmetric slice. And it turns out that the area of the horizon matches with the Cardy entropy evaluated at the saddle point weight in the norm of the state. So this is going to be an important result. Okay, so now the tensor network representation of this CFT state is particularly simple. It just has one internal bond, one vertex, and the OPE block. And there is a precise way to relate the tensor network to spatial slice. So by construction of the tensor network, the bond dimension matches with e to the s Cardy. So, and we also showed that previously the area of the horizon matches with the Cardy entropy. So basically, now we have that the bond dimension of the tensor network is e to the area over area of the horizon by 4g Newton. Okay. Now let's talk about how to probe this apparent horizon. Now I add a probe particle to this background, and this is dual to the excited microstate, as shown here. And if you look at the geometry, the geodesic probe could go either inside or outside the horizon on the time symmetric slice, as you can see from these two figures. And the corresponding tensor network is as shown below. So the bond dimensions of these tensor networks are again set by the Cardy formula evaluated at the respective saddle point weights. Now the probe OPA coefficient, we are working in the random tensor approximation, so where the probe OP coefficient defines a random linear map between the two internal vector spaces associated with the two bonds. And recall that these spaces were the spaces of Virasoro primaries centered around the saddle point weights H1 and H2. Now, using the fact that the random linear maps between large dimensional vector spaces are approximately isometric or coisometric, depending on the relative sizes, we can write down a precise condition for the OP coefficient to define an isometric map. So basically, if the dimension of the bond vector space H2 is greater than the dimension of the bond vector space H1, the OP coefficient would define an isometric map. And in terms of saddle point weights, that would mean H2 must be greater than H1. Okay, so I will not bore you with the details. Here is the result. So the difference between the saddle point weights has this nice formula, where m is the mass of the probe, l is the area of the horizon, and r and theta are the locations of the probe on the spatial slice. In a coordinate system where the horizon is at r equal to 1, r greater than 1 is the interior of the black hole, r less than 1 is the exterior. And as you can clearly see, there is a transition at r equal to 1. So the saddle point weight H2 is greater than H1 outside, whereas the saddle point weight H2 is smaller than H1 when the probe is inside. Therefore, we have shown that the horizon is like a unitary locus for geodesic probes, or the probe OPE undergoes an isometric transition across the horizon. Okay, so now let's turn the crank on the mass of the probe particle. So we can ask, what happens to the isometric transition when we make the probe operator heavy? By heavy, I mean heavy. It is heavy enough to create a new minimal surface. There is a precise way, like how heavy it should be to create a new minimal surface, but I can discuss the details later. So again, the question is again the same. What is the relation between the two bond dimensions in the tensor network below? And to get some intuition, let's look at the spatial slice of the resulting black hole geometry. So as I told, there are now two minimal surfaces. The outermost one is the horizon, and there's also an inner minimal surface. And now the areas of both these minimal surfaces are given by the Cardy formula evaluated at the corresponding saddle point weights. And as you can see from this figure, if the area of the surface, area of the minimal surface gamma 1 is smaller than the area of the minimal surface gamma 2, that means the bond dimension H1 is smaller than H2, which means the operator O acts isometrically. So you observe something interesting, which is that heavy operators can act isometrically even if they are hidden behind a horizon. And you can make this very precise because you can derive an exact relation between the saddle point weights. By exact, I mean it's exact in the weight of the heavy operator. And I won't go into details of how to derive any of this, but importantly, the locus where the isometric transition occurs is inside the horizon. So basically, I want to say something a bit vague, which is that the unitary locus of a heavy operator is like a non-perturbative generalization of a horizon. Okay, so let's change gears slightly, and we can show, like now I'm going to show that our tensor networks also obey a toy version of the island rule formula. And the setup that I'm going to use is very similar to the West Coast model. So let's consider the microstate that I've described just previously. And so far I've been ignoring the flavor labels on the operators. So now let me put back the flavor labels. So this defines a flavored microstate. And now I entangle this flavored microstate with a radiation reservoir. And if I do that, the resulting flavored microstate entangled with the radiation is what I call psi tilde, and it is and it corresponds to the tensor network that you see there. And I have also labeled all the bond dimensions in this network. NF and NF prime denote the number of flavors. So just for simplicity, I'm making only two of the operators flavored, but you could also make all of them flavored, and that will also be interesting to discuss. Whereas you have these usual bonds, which I discussed previously, where the bond dimensions is e to the area over 4g Newton. And now we want to calculate what is the entropy of the radiation state in this tensor network. And it's quite simple. We know that for random tensor networks, the entropy of a subregion is calculated from the minimal number of cuts needed to remove the subregion from the network. Okay, so let's apply that prescription to the setup. So you get three terms. So the first term comes from the cut A in this network, where you just cut the radiation legs. And the second term comes from cut B, where you cut one radiation leg and you cut one internal leg. Whereas the third term comes from cutting the leg corresponding to the horizon. So clearly, this is like this gives like sort of an interesting page curve where it seems that there are two transition points, but the entropy of the black hole finally saturates to the area of the horizon. And very roughly speaking, maybe you could think of this as a toy model for evaporation of an old black hole which has been made young by throwing in heavy stuff. Because that's what happened, right? Because I took the heavy operator O, and then I just used it to move the minimal surface, as you can see here. And I've not made that heavy operator charged, so I could also make the third one charged, and it would be even more interesting to discuss what would be the page curve, etc. Okay. Now this agrees with the expectation that we. Expectation from replica wormholes, which are constructed by branching around either of the minimal surfaces. So the first term comes from the trivial surface, and the second term comes from the inner minimal surface, and the third term comes from the horizon. And you can think of each of these terms as coming from corresponding replica wormhole geometries, as I've drawn here. So the first term is the black hole geometry. And the second term is a replica wormhole geometry, which is contributing to the fourth Rényi entropy. And this second term is basically constructed by branching around the inner minimal surface. So that's why you see one of the particle is starting from the boundary and then ending on the same boundary. And then finally, the last term is obtained by branching around the horizon, which is the outermost minimal surface. And that is going to give the third term. Okay. So these wormholes can also be given a coarse-grained description. And we have a prescription to coarse grain these holographic states. And I'm going to state that prescription in the language of tensor networks. So recall that the spatial slice of the black hole, which I was discussing, looks like this, and the corresponding tensor network state, written as a density matrix, is what I've written on the right. And now we can define a coarse grain state outside the horizon, gamma 2. And the way I coarse grain this state is by introducing an identity contraction between the corresponding legs of the network. So this black dot that you see that I've introduced is an identity contraction which basically fixes the internal primary that is running in these channels. And now you can show that the Rényi entropies of this coarse grain state match with the partition functions of the replica wormholes obtained by branching around the horizon. For example, the fourth Rényi of the coarse-grained tensor network state corresponds to the gravitational partition function of this four-boundary wormhole. And so using the replica trick, you can show that the area of the coarse-grained entropy of the state matches with the outer entropy, or which is the area of the horizon over 4 g Newton. But there is an important caveat here. The tensor network states that I've been discussing, the tensor network states I've been discussing are like fixed area states. So their entanglement spectrum is flat. So you should really think of these wormholes as fixed area versions of the wormholes that I'm drawing here. But we can actually compute the exact wormhole amplitudes by avoiding the saddle point truncation. It's because it's the saddle point truncation that is requiring you to think of the tensor network state as a fixed area state. Okay. So so our prescription is sort of different compared to the complexity coarse graining procedure of Engelhardt and Wall, and I feel it'll be very interesting to understand how this is related to the complexity coarse graining procedure. If the coarse grained state actually matches with what we have written down here. Okay, so to summarize. I described how to construct a quantitative tensor network models for ADS3-CFT2 using OPE data defined on the same graph as a Virasoro conformal block. And I discretized the three-dimensional black hole geometries in the sense that the tensor network is the dual graph associated with the pair of pans decomposition of the time-symmetric spatial slice. And I showed that the areas of minimal surfaces in the bulk match with the bond dimensions of corresponding internal legs in the network. And I showed that in the random tensor approximation, the probes undergo an isometric transition across a minimal surface in the bulk, and also showed that our tensor networks display a toy version of the island rule formula. So if I had to summarize my entire talk using one figure, I think this would be the figure. So where you have like a really generic pure state black hole in 3D gravity with a lot of heavy operators, a lot of minimal surfaces and probe particles, and then the corresponding tensor network shown below. Okay, let's discuss some future directions. So I didn't really discuss too much about going away from the Gaussian approximation, but locality, if you start thinking about how does locality constrain holographic codes, you'll see that crossing symmetry requires that there are non-Gaussianity corrections to the ETH ansatz. So which means like it would be really interesting to systematically correct the holographic codes beyond the Gaussian approximation using crossing symmetry. And one place where there is some quantitative change is the deviation bounds derived by Akers et al. In their paper. So it'll be interesting to see how locality affects the deviation bounds. And it'll be interesting to also construct finer grained tensor networks using CFTs. And there is a nice paper by Bao, Source, Pennington, and Wall, which is also mentioned in the previous talk. About tree tensor networks, which basically discretize the transverse direction along the boundary, and also they generalize to the loop tensor networks, which also discretize the transverse direction along minimal surfaces. Like it'll be really interesting to understand how to construct these kind of tensor networks from CFTs, because that will help us understand how to construct sub-ADS local tensor networks using CFTs. And then finally, it will be quite great if there's a way to construct dynamical or time-dependent tensor networks from CFTs, but I don't have anything useful to say in that direction. That's all, thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Yes, Ping.
I just have a simple question. So if you just have one heavy operator, usually we say if it's up above the bound, you will have a black hole, right? And in that case, it seems, what is the code could be?
Sorry, you said
so if you just have one heavy operator, yeah, do you have an extremal surface in this tensor?
Well, one primary operator cannot create a black hole. You need at least two of them.
Why? I think you have one heavy operator acting on, then that create a black hole state, right?
You mean an operator above the black hole threshold?
Yeah, you can. Above the threshold, you have one Harvey operator that corresponds to black hole, right?
Well, I'm talking about operators which are below the black hole threshold, and the operator that you're talking about is an internal operator which runs in the internal channel. So that is above the black hole threshold. But I'm not totally sure, like how you would add. Like a heavy operator. I mean, I can't describe the geometries, but basically what I'm saying, if the operator is above the black hole threshold. Because in this case, I can work in the world line approximation where the operators are basically like conical defects which are propagating through the hyperbolic ball geometry. Whereas if you push the operators above the black hole threshold, then you have to flatten these conical defects. I'm not totally sure if that kind of a geometry is well understood.
Okay, so basically here you require all the heavy operator to below the threshold?
Yeah, below the threshold, but sufficiently heavy, yeah.
Okay, I see, yeah. Thank you.
Yes. Yeah. So it seems that all the networks that you get are like matrix product states, they're basically a string of tensors. Could you argue that all different configurations are equivalent because of crossing symmetry?
Good question. So there's one caveat that I didn't discuss, which is there are definitely more minimal surfaces on the spatial slice than the number of bonds in the network. So there are some minimal surfaces which cannot be seen in this network. But that is basically because of crossing symmetry. So when constructing this tensor network, I first chose an OPE channel to expand, and then I truncated to the saddle point. So that means I'm only picking certain minimal surfaces. But to get all the minimal surfaces, I have to like expand using all the different channels, and then I'll be able to see all the minimal surfaces in some OPE channel. So that's the statement of crossing. Yeah.
Thanks.
I have a question regarding the last part of replica wormholes. I thought in 83 CFD2, still the existence of replica wormhole is debatable, but is your analysis says there must exist replica wormholes for 83 CFD2 cases as well?
They do, these are space-time wormholes which can be constructed by taking quotients of H3.
Okay.
I'm not talking about those constructions very like explicitly, but you can construct all of them using quotients, obviously.
Mm-hmm. And this computation is in ADS3 CFD2.
Yeah, this computation is in ADS3 CFD2. Like the way to compute this wormhole partition is using a procedure called Virasoro TQFT, where you basically cut this wormhole into pieces and then compute, and then determine the state and then think of this wormhole as an overlap between two states. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Great, if that's it, let's thank John again.